Welcome everyone. In light of having to postpone our in-person ILS NYC 2022 conference, which is now being held on April the 22nd, we decided to run some interviews with the kind sponsors of the event to showcase their thought leadership and thank them for their support. So tickets are still available. If you'd like to attend our conference in April held in person in New York, please do visit the Artemis website and you can secure your place at the event today. So for this event video, I'm delighted to welcome Christian Bruns and Michael Starhell, two partners and portfolio managers from LGT ILS Partners, one of our associate partners for the conference. Welcome, both of you. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you very much.
So as ever, we're looking at the development of the insurance linked securities market, and the LGT ILS Partners team has got a long history in the sector, and you manage approaching 5 billion of assets across your range of funds and strategies. And I thought it would be interesting to hear an update on activities at LGT, but also your thoughts on the marketplace at this time. And so to begin, perhaps Christian, I could start with you and you could give our viewers a quick update on what's been going on at LGT ILS Partners.
Sure, absolutely. So we are a team of 21 people based in Switzerland, and we'll obviously get to that in a minute. We also have our own in-house rated reinsurer, Lumen Re in Bermuda. Four people at Lumen Re. We've basically increased headcount there over the last couple of months in line also with regulatory requirements and basically to have the presence on the island. As you mentioned, we are just shy of $5 billion assets under management. Those are distributed across a range of different commingled funds and single investor mandates that we run, which are, let's say, bespoke in nature. Other than that, obviously happy that Corona is coming to an end, as it seems like, and we can hopefully all meet again in person rather sooner than later.
Yes, absolutely. That's our hope, that we'll start to get more back to normal and the industry can begin to fall back into its ways of getting on planes a lot of the time, I would imagine. Michael, moving over to you, perhaps continuing on a similar thread, you could describe some of the key features of the LGT ILS Partners allocation strategy.
Of course. I think on the allocation strategy, what we can say is that we are if that term exists, we are probably a very traditional ILS manager. We fundamentally believe that the one space where an allocation for capital market investor truly makes sense is natural catastrophe risk. So our focus is really predominantly on natural catastrophe risk. We do not write life risks, any specialty risks. We don't believe that the ILS market is the optimal place for that type of risk. We do believe that the market of the traditional reinsurance industry that has developed over the last 150 years is very efficient for exactly that type of specialty risk, where the actual capital pool is not necessarily the driver, but more the know-how, the expertise, and the element of diversification that such an investment or allocation for a reinsurer means. So on our side, it's really property cat. And then point number two, and for property cat, predominantly, we transact directly with primary insurance companies. So 90% of our portfolio is really excess of loss reinsurance with primary insurance companies. And our panel consists of around 100 such transaction counterparties. And we focus on the most developed markets. So clearly, US, Europe, Japan, Australia, Canada.
And are you well diversified across those regions?
Well, as diversified as we can be, again, we're talking property cat. So within the US, of course, then we're looking at quake, wind for Europe, for Japan, for Australia as well. We, of course, try to be diversified. And thanks for mentioning this. It's probably one element how we distinguish ourselves within the industry. Again, we still fundamentally believe, and I think we will be talking about the last 5 years and the event activity that we have seen over the last 5 years. But we still fundamentally believe in diversification. We can see that there is a lot of merits, and if you have allocated large amounts of money into Florida for the last 1 to 3 years, that may have worked well. But the downside potential of one individual event is on our end is still worrisome. We don't believe that an institutional investor, a pension fund, which is our main client, as Christian mentioned, a pension fund investor should lose 40, 50, 60% of the ILS allocation from one single event. So we try to diversify as best as we can within the limitations of natural catastrophe risk. But we try to work our portfolios in a way that any single event should not cause us or should not drive our portfolio into the negative of more than, say, 12, 14, 15% of our overall exposures.
Mm. So a clear property catastrophe focus. And Michael, you said that the ambition to diversify into other classes of business perhaps isn't so strong at LGT, but obviously this is a trend that we're seeing quite broadly now, a lot of interest in diversifying. Christian, maybe have you got anything to add on areas such as specialty or the life market? Is there any particular reason for remaining on the property cat side, or do you think in time some of those risks may become more appealing?
Well, we firmly believe that the property cat side is obviously the part of the business which consumes the most capital, typically at our counterparties, at the cedents, basically the most regulatory capital. And as a result, it makes sense for these counterparties to buy a hedge and to buy a hedge at a certain premium, obviously at a premium that's interesting for us and our investors. If the more you go into diversifying risks, obviously the lower that premium becomes. So as a result of that, we've been always very hesitant to engage, especially on the specialty side, but also on the life side. On the life side per se, whilst we don't have anything against really, let's say, pandemic covers or extreme mortality covers or longevity covers, I think the issue we see that on the pandemic side, a lot of these transactions actually now evidenced also what has happened during COVID, basically where none of these covers have been affected, are extremely remote. And as a result, basically you're writing business that pays maybe one or two online, which in our mind is not something that we or our investors should be exposed to, right? On the longevity side, we see a bit the structural issue that a lot of our investors are pension fund clients who obviously by the very nature of what they do, they have a ton of longevity exposure already. So in our view, it's a bit counterintuitive if a pension fund then also starts deploying money on longevity risks, basically on the asset side. And maybe as a last comment, some of the products we see on the life side, they are called ILS, but in our mind, actually, they have very little to do with what ILS actually stands for. A lot of these products are more financing transactions. So, for example, commission financing or certain regulatory transactions. Some of these transactions, actually, they have a lot of asset risk, a lot of financial risk, interest rate risk, etc. And all these are actually characteristic that an ILS investor is not looking for when he or she is allocating to ILS, right? Because you want to have an asset class that is decorrelated and removed from financial markets. You don't want to have an allocation to life ILS risk, which then highly correlates basically what happens in finance.
Yeah, quite a different beast sometimes, the life space, it seems. As a quick follow-on, what about cyber? This morning we published an article where broker Gallagher Re is forecasting that the cyber reinsurance market could be larger than the property catastrophe reinsurance market before 2040. Do you think that could ever become an appealing area for ILS?
We've looked at cyber. The issue we have with cyber is it has actually a lot in common with this lovely corona pandemic. It is a systemic risk, right? And as a result, it is very, very difficult to use this as a diversification element. It also has, again, a lot of times then implication on financial markets. So basically, if you're an investor, then you're basically getting a double whammy, right? You lose on your cyber ILS side and you lose on the financial market side. But I think it's very much the systemic nature, right? So all big companies use the same servers, service providers. Everybody runs Microsoft Windows, uses Office, the same cloud providers. And as a result, it's a risk that's very, very difficult, first of all, to look through it, basically, to decipher the correlations and the causalities. And it is a systemic risk that in our mind is a very, very difficult add-on to ILS. Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you, Christian. So that gives our viewers a really good overview of the LGT ILS Partners operation and your thesis for reinsurance investing. But what of market conditions? Now that we've got the important January renewals behind us, Michael, what did you think of market developments and in particular the pricing environment?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think on our end, what we have seen now is a fundamental change in the way not we necessarily, but the market is viewing and underwriting risk. And I think over the last years, we all had our fair share of the losses. Whilst our investors have not necessarily lost money over the last 5 years, they have over time also not really make a lot of money. And clearly the ILS allocation mid to long term should yield a positive return. Our investors are able and willing to take the event-driven risk, so they understand what risk they take. But then after a year like 2017, they would also expect to see some solid years. And now 2021 was the fifth year in a series of difficult years. And as a response, I think many ILS allocators have started to review their allocation, have potentially started to reallocate or shift their allocation. We also see amongst reinsurance companies an increased pressure in focusing again on technical returns, positive technical returns. If we look at Swiss Re, Swiss Re had to report net negative returns of 800 million back in 2020. And as a result of that, we have seen significant underwriting actions across the board. And so on our end, we were able to really now benefit from this fundamental shift and fundamental change that we have seen in the industry. We are, of course, whilst we are in ILS terms, probably a bigger player, we are in the bigger scheme of things in reinsurance, we are only a small allocator. So clearly we cannot drive the market, but we can select individual transactions that fit our portfolio best. Still overall, we are part of a market where we have now seen a shift to the positive. And what I mean is that we can see that primary insurance companies have started to really review their own portfolio. Whom are they selling cover to? Where is this building? Let long information, altitude information, much more granular data points are being reviewed and assessed by primary insurance companies when they start to compile their own portfolio. Many primary insurance companies, especially also in Europe, have started to reshape their market share. They try to reduce market shares in areas where they have ultimately gained too much of a market share. And now with, say, you know, for instance, the floods in Germany, some of our local partners have really lost a lot of money. And they, whilst then reinsurers and ILS markets have also had their share of the losses, the biggest chunk of the loss was still sustained by those primary insurance companies. And they're now reviewing and reassessing the way they're conducting business. And then on our end, we were able to now restructure our portfolio and to improve the allocation within our portfolio fundamentally. Again, not because we were driving this, it's also driven by the entire market. And so to be more precise, what we have seen is that a push for higher retention levels for primary insurance companies, so higher attachment levels across the reinsurance programs, which clearly benefit ultimately our risk structure within our portfolios. We have seen elements that we've started to really scrutinize. We have seen such elements to go away. If you look at the aggregate transactions, there's a big discussion around aggregate transactions per se. And we understand many ILS managers have started to retreat from aggregate transactions or shift away from them entirely. We're not that, I would say, negative on these type of transactions. We can see that primary insurance companies, it goes back to a point that Christian made, we see ourselves as a partner to our cedents, our counterparties, the primary insurance companies. They're buying the protection as a hedge, yes, as a hedge, but also as an element of their capital pool that they are able to show to their rating agencies and predominantly the regulators. And so aggregate transactions form a vital part of that purchase. And so we don't think that we should not support our clients, our counterparties. That's the way we view our cedents as our clients. We don't want to just walk away from these type of transactions because you can see they are needed. They're an integral part of the way such primary insurance companies are ultimately capitalized. So rather than walking away, we were working hard on improving the terms so they can work for us again, which means get rid of franchise deductibles, introduce hard deductibles, and of course, higher hard deductibles, introduce higher attachment levels, and sort of make aggregate transactions, again, a capital protection rather than an earnings protections type of transaction. And so for this past renewal round, to come back to your actual question, we have seen a fundamental hardening of the market, an increase in terms, which means not necessarily an increase in premium only. Of course, premiums have increased, but we on our end have started to use that premium increase not just to show a higher running yield across our portfolios, but rather keep the running yield at a healthy and also attractive level, and then try to improve the underlying portfolio structure. De-risking is a term that we've used often now over the last 2 months, try to de-risk our portfolio, but still maintain the client relationship. And I think as a last comment, we've had a difficult year, 2021, clearly, with our large allocation to Europe versus the US. But we think we can now also get the best out of that situation. We've paid our share of losses. Our clients, our investors now have paid their share of losses. So instead of walking away now, we were able to really make best use of that situation, increase our allocation where we felt that it's appropriate at better terms. And if I say better terms, again, not necessarily higher premiums, but fundamentally structural terms where we have seen an improvement. And as a last comment, and we don't think this was just the 1-1 renewals. We're now already in discussions with our counterparties in Japan for the 1st of April renewal round. We have already been contacted by all of them, and there's this clear sort of, I wouldn't call it a fear, but there is a bit of a concern in the market that even in Japan, some allocations will see a reduction. And so we've already, again, tried to make best use of that. We have already started to indicate our terms, started to indicate where we feel that it would be appropriate to see changes in structural conditions of the transactions and how we intend to go into the renewal round. And maybe one last example, as you may know, we have since a couple of years now, our own legal counsel as part of the team. What we have done in October, towards end of October, we have sent out our what we call renewal message to the brokers and to our counterparties, where we have already listed, not clearly in more generic terms, not specifically on individual programs, where we have listed the concerns, sort of the no-goes for us, where we want to see considerable improvements. And we felt this was very well received. It's a clear signal to the market, but also this, we do have the capacity, but this is what we want to see in the course of the renewal round. And that gives a strong message to the market. So I think we've gotten the best out of this renewal round. And certainly Christian and I, we've been doing this for almost 20 years now. I think it's fair to say that this was probably one of the most rewarding renewal rounds in many years now.
Interesting. That's really positive to hear as well, because too often the focus shifts away from actually providing the products that clients want. And it's all about getting the highest rates you can from people, but actually you've got to keep the product useful, and you've got to provide what insurers are really going to find, as you say, a useful protection for their portfolios. So it's encouraging to hear that aggregates are still available, but on sensible terms, which makes a lot of sense. A final quick follow-on for you, Michael, there. Any thoughts on Florida? Obviously we're seeing and hearing a lot of news about insurers suffering a lot more pain there as well. What are your expectations for June?
Traditionally, our allocation to Florida was rather limited. Again, our overall allocation to the US, it's significant, of course. We're talking 40 to 50% of our overall exposures that are allocated in the US and also for US wind. But then again, in comparison to many of our peers, that is a small allocation. And so we were able to be very selective, especially when it comes to Florida. And obviously the Florida market and the challenges around the Florida market that would probably do for another 2-hour discussion here. I think suffice to say, in our portfolio, we didn't have a lot of challenges because, again, we were very selective with the counterparties, already visible then in 2017, where our allocation to an event like Irma and ultimately the impact from adverse loss development was minimal. But we do believe that this could be also now an optimal point in time for the upcoming Florida renewal to implement certain changes, certain amendments. And so just again, to name one element that we really don't like and we don't feel it's appropriate to pass that cost on to reinsurers is the loss adjustment expenses. We do feel that if you're a large enough company and you have in-house legal counsel and in-house loss claims management people, that is your running cost as a primary insurance company. That should not be allocated as part of the loss, to the reinsurance and ILS community. And so that just gives you one example where we do believe we can improve the terms and conditions. Again, not focusing on the premium, but really make the optimal use now of the current hardening market situation to remedy some of the concerns that our industry has had for many years.
Interesting. That's a very interesting comment on loss adjustment expenses as well, because as you say, there is a degree at which insurers really need to be working to control those internally. And it's maybe not so fair to just expect to be able to pass the entire cost onwards. Thank you, Michael. Very interesting. Christian, moving back to you now, LGT ILS Partners, you're one of the firms that has been operating your own rated reinsurance underwriting vehicle, Lumen Re. Perhaps you could explain the role of Lumen in your value chain and maybe some of the benefits you find from using the rated structure.
Yeah, sure. So Lumen actually is a quite old structure. The company is going to be soon 10 years old. We originally started it basically as a segregated account company back in the days. We then converted it to a special purpose insurer. Was actually the first SPI that was licensed to do multiple deals, because previously, obviously, SPIs were basically only used as a one-off vehicle for cat bond transactions. So we did that upgrade, and then obviously we converted it into a Class 3A fully fledged commercial reinsurer, and then in 2017 obtained the AM Best A rating, which we're very happy, obviously, that that worked. The original idea was we basically, when we looked at our business, we actually had almost like an offsite or a strategy discussion to identify basically certain business risks that we have. And back in the days, before we had the rating, obviously we used a lot of fronting. So for every deal, obviously, that has a reinstatement, typically you need somebody who has a rating who can front it for you, right? And then you obviously also have a lot of cedents. Basically, they see the merits of collateralized three, but they just don't want to deal with collateral, right? So they would rather face a rated entity. So of course, you need a fronter. And when we looked at it, we basically said, hey, we have all this fronting in place. What happens if, let's say, one of the fronting companies runs into an issue? Or let's say, what happens if senior management at one of the fronting companies decides, you know what, we are no longer fronting business, right? Then you have an issue, because you're not the counterparty. You don't really have the direct relationship, basically, with your cedents. It's always the fronter who is signing the reinsurance agreements, right? You also might have a little bit, let's say, difficult situation when it's about claim settling, right? So you write maybe the contract as LGT ILS, but maybe the fronter also, they write this business for their own account. Mm-hmm. So what happens if you disagree with how claims are presented, right? Or there's just a general disagreement. You don't share the same view. So basically, how are you dealing with this? And when we looked at this, then we basically said, hey, we have a company, it has a good operating track record, it's been around for a while, we should get a rating. And then basically we started this project back in 2015, actually, to then go through the rating process with AM Best to do all the modifications, all the requirements that they have, all the reporting, to be really ultra transparent. And then basically end of 2017, we got the A rating, and it has worked very well so far. So the original reason or raison d'être for Lumen Re was really a mitigation of business risk. Mm-hmm. What obviously comes into play then is it also helps with operational efficiency. So that's also not obvious to a lot of people. If you collateralize business, you obviously, you have hundreds of LOCs outstanding, letters of credit, or you have hundreds of trust accounts, right? And each of these trust accounts has sub-accounts. So you need to build a whole basically operational ecosystem to just manage this. Versus if you write business on a front-end basis, obviously a lot of that falls away. So basically easing the operational burden, not just on us and our team, but also on cedents, right? Because that's why a lot of them, they like collateralized re, but they don't like the collateral because it's sometimes so painful to deal with it. And then really the third reason obviously is Lumen Re fundamentally helps to improve portfolio efficiency and to basically get better result, because it removes certain costs which are inherent in external fronting, and it helps you to make the portfolio more efficient. For example, if you want to roll over deals, right? If you do it on a rated basis, well, the collateral, we still have the collateral in place. It's just we manage it on our end, right? We don't push it somewhere and then someone else has to roll it and we have to change things. So that's much more efficient. And I think people also have come to appreciate when it's the famous trapped collateral, you can obviously get around a lot of it if you have your own rated vehicle. You still, obviously, you need to be absolutely spot on when it comes to reserving. So sometimes people think if you have a rated structure where you don't need to reserve anymore, or you don't need to reserve appropriately, right? So that's not the way how we run it. The reserves have to be spot on. And if you put up a reserve, obviously you can't redeploy that money. But if you have a layer that's $1 billion in length and the first 1 million is scratched, well, you don't have the $999 million sitting around for like 3, 4, 5 years time until maybe at a certain point you commuted. So obviously there, investors get a big benefit out of Lumen Re.
Absolutely. And do you have a feel for what percentage of your business is now flowing through Lumen Re? Is it the majority of the writings?
It's the majority. We've just actually looked at this figure, basically seeing how this has evolved over the last, now it's almost 5 years, right? Since 2017, since we got the rating, and we are now on the fronting, external fronting side, we are now down to less than 5% of our overall business. Yeah, so nice. It has worked very well for our investors and for us. And obviously that's also why we put the people behind it. Why we now have 4 people in Bermuda. We actually still have open positions also there. Really to build out the platform we have in Bermuda.
Great. No, that sounds very positive, Christian. I mean, following on from that, Michael, have you got any plans for Lumen Re going forward? Are there any future developments we should expect to see?
Well, it's a bit premature to go into details. Suffice to say, we've had over the last years, and the corona made it a bit difficult to travel and to follow up on some of these leads. But we've had several inquiries from institutional investors. They're looking at the ILS space, and they realize that probably the most efficient way to allocate into the ILS space, if you can take a longer term, is through a private equity type of allocation into a rated carrier. And so we had actual investors reaching out to us actively. And we're currently looking at this. I think it is a very attractive option for us and for those investors, essentially for all investors within the LGT ecosystem, if I may use that term from Christian. And we are looking at potentially accepting additional equity investors directly into Lumen Re. This serves to build out the equity pool of Lumen Re, obviously strengthens the overall balance sheet power of the company. And again, it would allow external investors to allocate into ILS in a private equity type of allocation. Just one last comment. It's not an easy one because it's not a private equity investment like a traditional private equity investment, where you go into a company, you reshape the company, maybe you IPO it, maybe you do an M&A, and then hopefully you flip it and it's going to be three times the value. We're looking at someone that is looking at ILS as a risk and then in the most efficient way. But there are a few institutional investors out there that have looked at ILS over a long period of time, found this to be now the optimal time to allocate is when certain, I would say, shorter-term investors are redeeming, when the tourists start to move on, if I may use that term, then others are stepping in and are taking a much more focused view. And so, yes, there will be news around that hopefully soon.
Very interesting. And it makes a lot of sense, actually, for certain investors to want to get more involved in sort of the infrastructure side of things as well, if there's an access point there. So as we begin to wrap up this interview, I thought it would be interesting to first hear the LGT ILS partners' view on two hot topics. So first, Christian, going to turn to you, and perhaps you could provide some comments on climate change and climate risk. What are you doing at LGT to keep your investors educated on climate change's influence on the ILS market?
I mean, I think as a first answer to that is we firmly believe that there is climate change. And we also share the view that climate change means there'll be probably more events. So frequency is going to go up. And some of these events will be bigger than what we've seen in the past. So severity will be going up as well. I mean, I think our responsibility is really to, besides the education, as you mentioned it, to protect investors from the impact that climate change may have on our portfolios. And that goes very much in line with what Michael said earlier. Basically, looking into portfolios, scrutinizing which deals have caused a lot of the loss load over the last couple of years. So what has worked, what has not worked for us. And then basically doing a re-underwriting, a reassessment of these structures. So Michael mentioned aggregate deals, obviously, is a very important topic. Has been a very large driver of the loss load in our portfolios. And we've actually done a very big change, a lot of the re-underwriting already at 1-1. So basically, when we talk to our investors, we are very transparent. So the losses have happened in the past, but through the re-underwriting, basically, we can demonstrate that we are improving portfolios. So basically, you can look at what has been the performance last year, what's the performance if last year would happen again, right? And there should be a markable delta between the two, because otherwise, we are not doing our job correctly.
Yeah, and I suppose the really key thing is that alongside education, you are providing sort of the insights into how you're adjusting your portfolio to account for climate risk. And that's interesting, goes very well with the comments Michael made on sort of the portfolio steering at the renewals. So finally, Michael, moving over to you, the second hot topic I'd like to hear your view on is ESG. Obviously very, very popular topic in the insurance linked security space at the moment, but perhaps you could explain the LGT approach to this topic.
ESG, it is indeed a hot topic. Within our organization, I think we have to make a point here. ESG has been a very important topic for LGT as a company for many years. In fact, for over a decade. We were one of the first signatories of the PRI. As a matter of fact, our colleague Tycho Snayers is now serving his second term on the board of the Principle of Responsible Investment, the PRI structure. And so we almost have a mandate top down from the ownership of LGT Group, which, as you may know, is privately held, that we need to be responsible in the way we invest our money. And so it was very clear that when the European Union introduced the Sustainable Finance Directive, the SFDR. We started to look at this not from a marketing point of view. Okay, this could be big. This could be something that institutional investors want to see. So let's do it. We were really looking at it from a from an actual investment point of view. Can we adhere to these guidelines, to these new guidelines? Do we fundamentally believe that ILS can be part of an ESG allocation? And we have taken, we didn't rush in. And so in 2021, we have not taken any action to the outside world. We have spent a year, a full year, together with an external consultant to also assess the taxonomy of the SFDR. And we have come to the conclusion that weather and climate-related natural catastrophe risks are in fact ESG / responsible investments. And we do believe that our funds are those eligible to be allocated as a long-term sort of sustainable type of allocation. It's an interesting point now because it goes back to the very first question. It's a bit coincidence that we firmly believe that natural catastrophe risk is the sole business activity that we should endeavor in. We believe that capital market investors are looking for the event-driven type of risk. We believe, as Christian explained, that that's exactly the type of risk that also is a win-win situation when insurance companies are ceding that and passing this on to capital market investors because it ties up so much capital. And so it's actually quite a good fit now that we only do natural catastrophe risk, no specialty risk, where clearly you cannot make the argument that this should be sustainable or responsible investing. And so over the next months to come, we will reallocate all of our strategies and funds as per the Article 8 of the SFDR guideline. Article 9 is, in our view, a bit of a stretch. We do know that certain ILS measures are going around along that route. Again, probably would cover another 2 hours of a discussion why we don't believe that our funds can, at this point in time, be allocated in Article 9. But we do believe that a solid Article 8 product, a sustainable ESG-focused product, is a valuable asset. And it's just another, in our view, valuable add-on to ILS as an asset class, aside of the fact that it's lowly correlated, as we're now seeing, by the way, this week. We all know what's going on in Europe right now in Ukraine. And so we can see the resilience of the ILS allocation at work right now. Inflation is a big topic. Again, another element where ILS can help as an almost embedded inflation hedge. And now ESG, where we believe that we can serve a product that is fundamentally a sustainable, responsible type of investment. So ESG, we are embracing ESG within the organization. And the last point that we can make best use of an entire team that is working on the ESG topic. So we can also, this is where it's again, good to be part of a larger organization where you have the know-how and you have the expertise of people that are really focusing on this topic and this topic alone. And so we have developed an ESG assessment tool within our organization that we can also apply to screen our individual investments.
Very interesting. Thank you, Michael. And very, very topical mention of Ukraine there. And obviously, this is another period of time where we will see the ILS market demonstrate its lack of correlation at a time when so many other assets are now correlating together in one direction, it seems. Look, thank you both very much for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's been great to speak with you both. Thank you, Christian. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
So for our viewers, just to remind you, if you are keen to attend our conference in New York on April the 22nd, please do visit the Artemis website where tickets are available. Thank you both again.